Welcome to the Wealth Without Wall Street podcast, your guide to understanding how to get out of the Wall Street rat race and start your own mailbox money lifestyle. Now, don't let these handsome Southern draws fool you. These financial minds are teaching our country to enhance savings, increase cash flow, and create passive income, all without the help of Wall Street. Are you ready to break through? Now, here are your hosts, Russ Morgan and Joey Murray.
Welcome. This is the Wealth Without Wall Street podcast. Your host, Joey, the Italian Stallion Murray, joined as always by Russ, the idea guy Morgan. So, Russ, I'm just thinking back. I've got five little girls, as you know. They are always constantly coming up with ideas. They're coming up with, like, what do they want to be when they want to grow up? They were talking about bakeries that they want to start. They're talking, that's Lily Kate, by the way. She wants to be the baker. And Annie, she's an artist. She wants to think about how can she sell art. So I'm trying to think back. I don't even remember. What was your first investment idea? Like, what did you want to do when you grew up as far as investments?
First of all, give Lily Kate E-Myth, because remember, the baker was one of the first ones in there that
absolutely
was like, let's make sure we know that this passion we have, we have to organize, right?
Exactly.
Because she's a big thinker too. She's going to need somebody to help her manage that.
Yeah. I'll have to hire somebody for that.
Well, see, that I only mention that because I'm kind of that big thinker too, right? Like, I have an idea, but I know good and well I can't fulfill it.
Yeah.
I'm going to need somebody to fulfill it. So one of my first investment ideas was self-storage.
Okay. How did that come about?
Be honest, I don't even know. Like, I just, maybe it was that we had put something in a self-storage facility and the person had, you know, I just remember being in college and I think I used one for like 2 months or something like that. And I went there late and the person like literally woke up and let me in the facility.
The manager, the person on site.
Yeah, it was kind of back in those days where it wasn't like kind of come and go as you will.
Right.
And they were, I found out that the person lived there. And so then
you're like, ding.
Yeah, to me, it was like, okay, here's an opportunity, right? So my mom, you may have heard me say this on the podcast before, my mom raised my sister and I, and, you know, by herself. And I just wanted to, like, give back to her. So I thought, hey, when I get to a point, one of the first things I should do is go buy one of these self-storage places. I've been in college for all that period of time. Everybody used storage facilities. And then, boom, I got a place for not only my mom to have a job, I got a place for her to live.
Like, she could work for you.
Well, I mean, it wasn't like working for me, right? She was just going to be serving our customers.
It's so selfless of you to think like that.
Right. I mean, the bottom floor was going to be the retail spot, right? That's where you come in, you sign up,
sure,
you come pay, whatever. And then top floor, boom,
bedroom
apartment or something.
100%. How many bathrooms?
At least one and a half.
Okay.
I mean, when we were interviewing Steven Lightman today on the podcast, he says, hey, you know, one of the ways you cut down costs is that you really don't have toilets and showers and all that stuff. But I wanted to make sure she had a place, right? I want to have a place that I don't have to go into her bedroom. I could go into a half bath.
Yeah. Well, I see where you're going with this. I see. This is really son of the year status that you're attempting.
Yeah. Man, tell me, I was thoughtful. I was thinking ahead. Like, this is not usually where...
I was about to say, this is not normal.
People normally don't say, man, Russ, you really thought ahead on that one. No, I did. And Megan, for the longest time, said, you know, hey, here, when are you going to buy that facility for your mom? And when we built our house, our new house, there was a self-storage facility right there at the front of the neighborhood. And you know what? It came up for sale.
And you didn't buy it.
Well, I couldn't convince my mom to move to Birmingham.
Ah, okay. Well, your plan has just fallen apart here.
Well, and it wasn't as nice. It had like its own standalone kind of rickety shack that was off to the side. It wasn't like the upstairs apartment where she could come down the back stairs into the place. I mean, it was not what I had really envisioned.
It wasn't ideal. It didn't have that extra half bath.
No. And I think people need to know that there's an opportunity there. But
that's right.
As we dive into this, maybe you've been interested in self-storage, whether it was to get your mom a place to live and work later on in life. I don't know.
Maybe not for the same reasons, but maybe you're looking for passive income.
Yeah.
We're going to dive into that.
Well, hey, passive income, what's more passive than having literally like four, like 10 walls and really not a whole need, you know, a whole lot of need to management. I mean, it's like an asphalt parking lot. I mean, unless you get into one of these really super fancy, like climate controlled things, you got to worry about ACs and stuff. For the most part, these things take care of and manage themselves. Low occupancy. You're going to learn a lot of great things from our guest today. I really wanted you to listen to why he decided to not go buy an existing facility, but build from the ground up and build one of the nicer kind of class A spaces. So lots of really interesting takeaways. Let's jump into the interview right now.
Have you been listening to our podcast and wondering, am I the only person that knows about infinite banking? Or what about the five pillars of Wealth Without Wall Street? How can I learn more? Now is your chance. You can join the community that is learning this across the country.
Go to community.wealthwithoutwallstreet.com where you can access Q&As with all our podcast guests and live group coaching with some of the top experts from across the nation. And yes, I'm throwing in the Stallion and I in that. community.wealthwithoutwallstreet.com. Sign up.
Welcome into the show. We have Stephen Libman, real estate tycoon. Can we call you that?
Sure, I'll take it.
Well, Stephen, we really appreciate you coming into the show. Obviously, one of our clients, good friends, actually a previous podcast guest, Matt White, connected us, and he mentioned that you've been using the Culture Index in your real estate investment business. Is that right?
Yeah, love Matt, love the Culture Index. And I think we have a couple other synergies that we kind of share in. So yeah, I appreciate you guys having us on.
Yeah, so for people who don't know who Stephen Libman is, give us some background as to your company, what you guys do, how you got into the real estate world, and kind of all the fun things you're into.
Yeah, sure. So quick background, 2004, graduated from Boston University. Spent about 8 years in the real estate space as an agent and a broker, working for investors, watching people flip houses, read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, who didn't. Freedom is in real estate. And then we started a fix and flip and wholesale business about 9 years ago. Fast forward, we're probably the largest wholesale and fix and flip business in New Jersey, doing somewhere between 150, 175 deals a year. And in the last 12 to 18 months, we've moved our entire operation into the commercial real estate space because passive income is the real golden goose, right? So that has always been the goal. Why are we doing the wholesales? Why are we doing the flips? Why are we in real estate? It's to get into the commercial real estate investing world so that we can be in a truly passive position and create that generational wealth for us and our investors.
So you say commercial. So what are the things that you guys have moved into over the last 12 months?
So commercial is, it's, there's a lot of different places to be in commercial, right? But we specifically are in three verticals. We're in the student housing space. We're in the multifamily housing space, so apartment complexes. And then we're in the self-storage space, which is, I know, what we're going to focus on a little bit today, and with good reason.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, I'm interested, like, you know, that the model of student housing that – I was in the student housing business as well. I had one a condo and I got rid of it. I was in it and then out of it as quickly as I can. So when you say student housing, explain that a little bit.
I mean, Russ, that's not multifamily. That's single family. That's one family, one condo.
Yeah. Well, I don't think he didn't live there. So technically we can call it an investment. I'll let it slide.
Okay.
Yeah, the student housing complexes that we're in, I mean, we're talking about large off-campus student housing close to the campuses, but set up similar to a multifamily housing situation where the students are living there and commuting into school, but it's pretty close around the campus. So, you know, we're actually closing on one in about 90 days out in Oklahoma, a $12 million project, 368 beds. Student housing, for whatever reason, they don't count units, they count beds. I think it's because you get four or five students to live in one unit together.
I was about to say, like, are they legitimately figuring out how many, how much floor space you got? I can throw a mattress pretty much on about, you know.
Yeah, get those rack razors in there and you're good.
Yeah, 50 square foot. Yeah, okay, that equals one bed.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So besides the student housing, you did say you moved into self-storage. Okay. I have my reasons. I can imagine why you would go that route, but tell us, like, what is interesting about self-storage? Why is that a strategy that you guys are moving towards?
Yeah. So first, all things that I say is not something that you can call your attorney about and accountant about. No. So whatever disclaimers, right? I mean, this is just our experience, our own research, and this is why we love the space. And we're going to be in about 300,000 square feet of the space in just Orlando, Florida, by the end of this calendar year. So we're pretty heavy into it. And the first thing is nobody likes to use the word recession proof, but I kind of like to use the word recession resistant. 2007, 2008, self-storage was the only asset class in the United States that actually not only paid dividends back, but grew at a rate of 5% per year through the recession. So everything else was getting battered, and we're actually doing a podcast or YouTube on this pretty soon, that all real estate is not created equal, right? So there's residential, there's commercial, and even within commercial, self-storage had the lowest default rates of any asset class in the country in the last downturn.
Isn't it crazy that 1 out of 10 people are renting a storage facility out there?
It's insane. I mean, look, we're a consumeristic society, right? And when we acquire these things, we don't want to let them go. So it's a really sticky asset class too, right? Because once you put stuff into a storage facility, you kind of set it and forget it. And then after you look, 18 months later, you're like, man, am I still paying for this? I am, but I'm not going to go empty it out because that sounds like a lot of work.
It's just kind of like Russ's HBO a membership he paid for one time to watch one movie.
Still $7.99
a month. 2 years later, he's like, wait a minute, that was a really expensive movie.
I've done that research. I've looked at some of the stuff that you've had. We've had people in our community that have brought up the self-storage space, the RV and boat storage. So you guys, though, got into a different angle of it. Most people who get into the space are looking to go acquire existing units, but that's not what you guys did, right?
Correct. And when you say most people, I assume you mean passive investors, because
yes,
you know, there's a little bit of a lag time before they start cash flowing on new construction. But I'll tell you, there's a lot better metric. There's a lot more value to be created in ground up facilities, right? I mean, so
why is that, Stephen? I don't want to just assume what you mean by that.
Oh yeah. So I'm just saying, by doing the work, right, by putting the steel and the concrete in the ground and then doing the work of the lease up, then selling off to somebody that's looking for a stabilized cash flowing asset, there's a lot more value creation there than you would be able to find in, let's say, a mismanaged self-storage facility. There's value that you can create, but nothing like taking out of the dirt. So the caveat to that, though, is you don't want to build in oversaturated areas. You don't want to build where nobody's going to drive by it. So all three of our facilities are in Orlando, right? It's the second fastest growing city in the country, the number one growing city by job growth. Job diversity is huge there. Florida's done a really great job of bringing people to their state. Orlando specifically, I mean, in just our like 1 mile radius of our new facilities, you have over 3,000 new construction projects, not even out of the ground yet. So
wow.
The city's exploding, and it needs these types of facilities because they're just not existing yet. So if you do the feasibility study, which you have to do when you buy these things, it's basically a very expensive appraisal that comes in and says, yes, this project is or is not viable, and it scales it. If it's kind of viable, really viable, or man, you're going to be successful. And that's the graph, and what it looks like. And then you decide whether or not you're going to be able to do the, you know, the, are you going to spend the money to build there, and who's going to manage it for you, and all of the separate, you know, I know I'm creating a lot more questions than answers right now, but that's why we chose ground up, is because we can create a lot more value in it.
So, well, I mean, one thing you just mentioned, I don't want to miss before we move on to some other things. You mentioned you can create a lot of value by building this from the ground up and then selling it to somebody that wants a stabilized asset. Is that really kind of the end goal of these in your mind, or is it more just to hold for long-term cash flow yourself?
So if we get offered a ridiculous number, everything's for sale, right? But our goal to create generational passive wealth is to hold it long-term. Our investors might not be comfortable with tying up their money that long. So the ground up is great because it's not a 5 to 7 year horizon like a typical investment. It's more like 3 years, because once we build it and lease it up 50%, then we can do a refi and take their money out and put it into another project that we're doing. So
gotcha.
that's why we like it as well.
From what I've, you know, done a little bit of research on the self-storage space, you've got retirement, you know, those, the people who are in that baby boomer generation who are retiring, and obviously that number is increasing. I think 2023 is where we get to actually the big edge, and it goes for the next 7 years of the largest part of the baby boomer generation. And as they are now starting to sell homes, but like you said, they've acquired a ton of stuff over the time. That's where they're going to want to go save it because they don't want to give it away. I watch the shows American Pickers and everything else. You see stuff just piled up in places. It's beautiful. I'm assuming this is the reason why you chose Orlando. I don't know if you've got these three unit complexes out there surrounding the villages, but you know, isn't that what that retirement community?
The villages. We're like right there.
No, yeah, I mean, it seems genius. Is that the game plan? Is that why you guys chose Orlando? If not, tell me why.
Well, so a couple metrics. Two of the most staggering metrics are that millennials and baby boomers are the largest generations on the face of the planet, and both of them are in the highest rental bracket of anybody else. So the biggest populations in the United States are also the biggest renters in the United States. So as the elderly, or as the boomers, you know, that aren't elderly yet, are selling their houses, they're not just moving into rentals. I mean, they are, right, by droves. But the other thing that they're doing is downsizing.
Right.
Whether they're moving into a rental or whether they're downsizing, they need some storage space because they can't bear to get rid of the macaroni art from their third grandchild. Right. I get it, right? Yeah. I got macaroni art. You look around. I'm sure I got some.
Yeah.
Right? So it's they're downsizing. They need storage space. The millennials that are coming out of college, they acquire things, and you know, whether they inherit things through estates or whether they just acquire stuff because they're consumeristic, they also need places to put stuff. Also, they're living in more centralized urban areas, so they have smaller square footages.
Right.
The Jersey cities, the New York cities, the San Franciscos, the DCs of the world, you're renting for $4,000 a month in a 600 square foot space. Where are you going to put that piano that you bought? Like, it's just, there's a lot of need. And over the last two decades, that the new construction space in self-storage has absolutely exploded, but we still haven't gotten to a place of equilibrium yet.
Like from the standpoint of, like, there's still a lot more need than there is actually units to fill.
Yeah, you might have some oversupply and some oversaturated markets, and you can look at it pretty easily, right? Where has building slowed? So there's certain areas of Texas where building has slowed down, but there's other areas of Texas where it's still exploding. So, you know, we like Orlando because, again, the metrics I mentioned before, second fastest growing in population, first fastest in job growth. Little known secret about Florida, though, high water tables, no basements. So there's a ton going on in terms of new construction building, but nobody has any place to store these places or store this stuff. So, and then if they don't have basements, what's filled? The garage, right? So that moves to the RV and boat that we're doing as well. A lot of the HOAs around Orlando don't allow for RV and boat parking within the homeowners association. So you have an $800,000 camper, where are you going to put it? Well, I'm not going to park it out in the sun down by the bay, right? I'm going to put it on a covered RV and boat storage place that has nice amenities and is a Class A place that I can go park my stuff. So ton of metrics that we love about Orlando.
All right. So help me. I'm interested in this space, right? I've told Joey this several times. The introduction to this podcast is going to explain how I was going to own a self-storage facility, and I was going to have my mom set up for life. She was going to have her house, and she's also going to have a job. It was like a brilliant concept. I picked this out at like 20 years old. For no good reason. I didn't like do the math on it. Now, I had read a couple of books and people talked about self-storage as a great place, but I hadn't done any of the metrics. I just like, I need to take care of my mom, give her a place to live and give her a job. I mean, son of the year here.
Okay? I mean, absolutely son of the year. Good night.
So there's some lessons though. You started digging into this stuff and you've mentioned some of the demographics, you talked some of the cash flow, but there's some lessons that you've learned along this route. Like, what is it that you could teach me, someone who's not invested not one single dollar in self-storage yet, outside of my mental, you know, thought process on this as a 20-year-old kid? Help me understand, what are some things I need to know about this space that would help me avoid making a bad decision, but also some things I could look at would help me make a good decision?
So first, I mean, you know, partnering with good operators, right? I mean, you're not the first guy to ever invest into self-storage. So find other people that have been doing it well and ask them a bunch of questions, right? And that's kind of what we did before we decided to take the plunge into it. And our first project was a $14 million one.
Yeah. So what were some of those good questions that you asked?
Yeah. So like, why would I want to invest in this market? What markets do I want to avoid? What's the financing look like on a storage facility? You know, are there equity investors that are interested in this? Like, how could I get them interested in it? You know, so, I mean, the top level things about storage that I really love is that it's been not only an emerging market for the last 50 years, but one of the most recession resistant, right? So while every asset class is in a downturn, self-storage is in an uptick. I like that for diversification of asset class, right?
Yeah.
When the residential retail market gets hit, and I think you can talk to a lot of experts that say that it's probably at a good spot right now to where we're going to look for a correction in the next 5 or 6 years. Storage space is a great place to be. Feasibility studies are really important because you need a feasibility consultant to do those analytics for you, unless you want to do them yourself, which I don't. I know you get them either. No. Based on our culture indexes, right? And they're basically going to lay out what the demographic information looks like. What's the Census Bureau saying? What's the job growth looking like? Can the what size facility can this support? So when you have huge population growth, right, then if 1 in 10 people are absorbing a storage unit, how many units can you build before you get oversaturated? So that's a big number, right? I mean, we're doing a 1,193 unit, which is huge. It's on 14 acres. It's like, how do I know that the population around there can actually sustain that type of population in the area? And we're building ground up, so it's even a little bit more risky, right? Because it's not proven out yet. So there's a little bit of skepticism in terms of like, well, will it, won't it?
Well, so when I was doing some reading, you know, I came from a background when I got out of college, I was in this space with Enterprise Rent-A-Car where I literally rented cars for 4 years. I traveled around the U.S., managed these different operations, and we tried to run at 92%. That was our goal. Yeah. And so I learned a lot about the hotel industry, the same concepts, the airline industry running the same concepts. But when I was doing a little research, and I'm interested if this is an accurate statement, it said for a typical storage facility to break even, they only have to run in the 40s, like 45%. Is that an accurate statement?
Yeah, that's about right. I mean, think about your expense ratio. In a storage facility, you have, what, maybe one bathroom? Maybe two, right? There's not. So we own multifamily complexes too, right? Every unit has a kitchen, a bath, an AC condenser, a boiler, right? So you don't have those expense ratios in the storage space. So yeah, break even is somewhere between 40 and 50%, sometimes as high as 60%, right? It just depends on the cost of the facility and stuff like that. But nowhere near the 80, 85% of some of these multifamily complexes.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. I mean, these things all sound really, really good. Obviously location plays a factor. Like you said, the potential for competition around the units, like, oh, now everybody's building them, so now there's going to be a surplus of units, whatever. What are some of the other potential pitfalls, like negatives that people should be considering or thinking about if they're thinking about this as an investment type?
Yeah, well, I think about 18% of storage facilities are run by like the big three REITs, right? The Life Storage, the Public Storage, the CubeSmarts of the world. So the majority of the operators are still mom and pop operators. For me, I wanted to partner with a third party manager that had a lot of experience and a lot of square footage under their belt. So we partnered with CubeSmart. So CubeSmart is acting as a third party manager for us in all of these facilities. So they run the day to day. So I think management pitfalls are big, right? If you don't have self-storage experience and you're going to go buy your first facility, maybe you and your mom aren't the best people to run it.
Come on.
Maybe they are. I'm just saying maybe they're not.
I mean, she would be great.
Best front office.
Yeah, best front office. And by the way, mom, I would give you more than one bathroom in that house. We're going to keep the expenses down, but don't listen to him. 1.5 baths. It's yours.
You know, so those, I think those are some of the easy pitfalls, right? And then also what's going on with the financing in the space, right? Is there an appetite for financing these, whether they're new construction or whether it's existing? The short answer is there is. There's a ton of appetite for it because I think people smell a correction coming and they know that this was the most recession-proof asset class around. So if I'm an institutional investor who wants to put $10 million into an asset and feel pretty comfortable that it's going to sustain itself through the next downturn, they feel pretty good about storage.
So, Stephen, those are obviously some big things to consider. It sounds like financing is not a big issue today. It could be down the road. That's something to consider. What about, it sounds like to me, it could be costly to market these. Like if you start seeing other things pop up in the market, how do you stand out, you know, to become the place that they want to store their stuff with?
So, I mean, we build Class A facilities. So the metrics, I forget them off the top of my head, but the majority of the people that actually rent these things are going to be female consumers, right? So very well lit, really aesthetically pleasing. You can't, the days of the rows of lockers with like grass growing through the broken asphalt is over.
Yeah.
I mean, the facilities that we're building are like, I mean, they're state of the art. They're beautiful. But CubeSmart, our management company, really helps us to market those, right? So they're working with local builders, giving like move-in specials and things like that to get things leased up. And they take care of a lot of that work. So if you're an individual mom and pop, then I think there's some strategic things that you can do in terms of guerrilla marketing to really get out. But if you have a kind of broken down facility and you're not doing a lot of CapEx and making it really stand out and make it safe, then you're probably not going to get a lot of rental. You know, ours have all LED lighting and asphalt and concrete driveways and, you know, just everything's really high end and well lit.
So are you guys in the climate controlled space? Is most of your units climate control, or how do you determine that?
Yeah, our next unit mix is like 53-47 to the climate controlled side. And CubeSmart again. So we run our own feasibility study about how many units and what the unit mix should look like and, you know, what do we think? Because you need a unit mix before you go to the architectural and engineering design and things like that. But then our management company comes in and they do their own feasibility study and they kind of relay to us what they would like to see in the facility that they're going to run for it to optimize. So you have a bunch of different eyes on these things, looking at what's the best unit mix, how many controlled, how many non-climate controlled, you know, before we actually bought the land across the street, we were just doing, 1,193 units, plus there was another 2-acre parcel that we were paving into and covered RV and boat right there. And as we broke ground across the street, a competitor put a big sign up that said 100,000 square feet of rentable. And we said, well, that's not going to be great for anybody. So we went, knocked on his proverbial door and said, hey, you know, you got approved pretty quickly after us. And we didn't know that you were going to break ground. What do you want to do here? Right. It's going to kind of torpedo both of our businesses. And he said, well, I'd be willing to sell it for the right price. Right. And we came up with a game plan to turn that entire facility into RV and covered boat because the need is there. In a 5-mile radius, there's 100% occupancy in that space all the way around our facility. So there's waiting lists. If you go into, you know, if you Google Davenport RV and storage, you'll see the first 5 that pop up. If you have a camper to park, they don't have any space for you. So there, it was an underserved market. And if you do a side-by-side metric on whether or not RV and storage is going to return better on your investment or climate-controlled self-storage is, self-storage wins out by a little bit, right? So if you have the feasibility study that says it can accept both, most people will just do self-storage. But because we have the facility already in place and the need is underserved, we thought it would be a great complement. And you get the economies of scale of having one manager run both facilities.
Gotcha. Yeah, so have you considered other areas outside of Orlando? So obviously, you sounds like you guys have cornered the market. If I want to go build a self-storage facility somewhere, where are other areas that you think are great locations potentially to seek out this?
you're just going to look at the same demographics that we're talking about, right? Job growth, job diversity, population growth. And you're going to want to be careful, especially in this market, because there's significant slowdowns in those areas that, you know, so there's a lot of pockets in Florida, the Southeast, Midwest, they're both booming in terms of where populations are moving to, right? And I live up in New Jersey. It's like the number, I think California, New York, and New Jersey are the top three exited states in the entire country. So you go down to Florida and find a lot of Jersey guys, right? But if you're looking demographically where to be in storage, it's not that straightforward, because we're looking demographically where to build self-storage. So if you want to look at, for an existing facility, then that's okay, right? It's look at the previous metrics, look at, you know, why is there value to be added there? Is it just mismanaged? Or, you know, a lot of these guys, right, they'll own it for 30, 40, 50 years, like you and your mom, and they'll retire, and then they'll say, hey, let's sell it off to somebody else. But there's some deferred maintenance. There's some ways to increase rents. Maybe they haven't done it to stay competitive. So similar like any other asset, you're going to do an underwriting on it and see, right, hey, where's the upside? What kind of returns on investment am I looking for? And typically in storage, you tend to see a little bit higher return on investment.
So, Stephen, this has been really, really informative. I feel like, you know, everybody's going to learn from this. I want to bring it back full circle to something you mentioned up front about the passive nature of this. There's a reason that you went from the fix and flip, the wholesale model, to this, to create more passive income, or to make your income more passive, I should say. So break that down for us. I mean, just real briefly, as far as like, how does this become more passive for you as opposed to what you've been doing for the last, you know, 7, 8, 9 years?
Yeah. So for us on the sponsorship side, you know, finding, partnering with our co-sponsors who live in Orlando, by the way. So it's not like we just kind of decided, oh, that's a good area. He lives down there. He's managing the construction, all of that stuff. You know, so partnering with our co-sponsors, and then, you know, managing the management companies and things like that, it's much more passive than managing a flip, right? Yeah. In your single family condo, when the toilet broke, they called you, right? They called CubeSmart in our storage facilities. So they really manage all of that. And just in the commercial space in general, the economies of scale really allow you to hire third-party managers that are professional in their space. It's hard to manage a 1 or 2 or 3 family with a third party manager. It just doesn't, it's not cost effective.
Right.
So these larger projects, the 10, 12, 15, we're closing on a $28 million one soon here. The economies of scale allow for those investors to really lay back and be passive, right? And take their monthly or quarterly distributions. And that's what I love about commercial real estate, is it doesn't just pay you one time. It pays you every quarter in perpetuity until we sell the asset. So they get the economies of scale. They get the tax benefits, right? We get to utilize leverage to increase our returns on investment. So many reasons why commercial is better in general for me. But the passivity of being hands-off and just being able to manage the manager is really key for us. And then further down the line, right, you have our limited partner investors, and I'm invested as a limited partner in some other deals as well. And that's really nice, because I just get a monthly email update and a check in the mail. And I don't really have to do anything else. And that's why I really like my money being on the field in a place where, you know, it's earning some capital.
Well, just a, kind of going out on a limb here, because we've talked a little bit. We know a lot of the same people. You know, our audience uses dividend paying life insurance in order to, you know, employ their cash into projects like this. Is that something that you guys have ever heard of and used as well into your projects?
Yeah, so we do the same thing. We actually started our own policies internally to do flips. And nice. it was great, right? Because you get to, it gives you that additional benefit of being able to invest with your entire retirement plan into an arm's length transaction. But it wasn't, you know, we didn't want to continue doing that forever, right? So we're taking a little bit less of a return than we would on the fix and flip side of the business through the passive income model, because we don't have to touch it.
Yeah.
So, you know, my kids will be investors into our next storage facility that's closing in about 45 days. And they're going to do that through their life insurance policies.
Oh, nice. That's really cool.
As we're doing some paid up additions riders and we have like a deal closed and we have an extra 20, 30, 50, 100 grand, then we'll fund the policy, we'll turn around, we'll borrow against it, we'll put it into one of these vehicles. And I mean, you guys know much better than I do the level of asset protection that you get through that, and you know the benefits of having the dividends and also the investment paying you at the same time. So whatever we're paying our investors, right, it's getting paid even more through the dividends. And yeah, it was just a no-brainer for us, right? So you know, it's just get some cash, find, you know, which of the family members is getting a new policy.
who wants to get stuck next? Who's up? And I tell people all the time, they say, why do you have 19 policies? They're like, well, every year I need to get a new one because that's my way of getting a physical. Most people have to go wait, you know, set an appointment with somebody, go wait in the lobby for an hour and a half. I literally have made concierge medicine come to me. I've got it to where they come to me, they draw my blood, they test me out, they give me all the stuff. I don't have to go see a doctor anymore. I feel like I've got this thing by the tail. So
it's perfect.
Yeah. Well, man, thank you so much, Stephen. This has really been insightful, as Joey said earlier. And for those of you who are not a part of our community, go to community.wealthwithoutwallstreet.com. You can get a chance to actually hear the live Q&A we're going to be doing with Stephen. Your questions, the things that you'll send in to us over the next week or two are going to be the things that Stephen's going to be answering. And, you know, these are the great opportunities. I love to be able to network with people like yourself who are thinking differently about money, who are actively doing what most of us want to do, which is become passive investors. And you've already become a hero in that. I'm so stoked that you're doing exactly what we're doing with life insurance. That was an awesome thing. And really appreciate you as a guest. And Joey, any other parting shots before we let Stephen go?
No. I just, again, want to encourage you. If you think that we did a terrible job of asking the right questions to Stephen, then be a part of the live Q&A in our community. That's what your opportunity is. Every week when you hear our podcast guests, you should be getting involved with the community to ask your own questions that we may have left out. So yeah, Stephen, thank you again. And thanks to Matt for connecting us. And we look forward to having you in the community.
This has been the Wealth Without Wall Street podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show to break free of the Wall Street mindset and begin building wealth on your own terms in places you understand, so that your wealth will never run dry. See you next episode.